This is the Books and Authors Fantasy Podcast, episode 121. Good day and welcome to this episode of the Books and Authors Fantasy and Sci-Fi Podcast. I'm your host, podcaster, and author of Fun Fantasy Reads, Jamie Davis. This podcast is exactly what the title says it is, folks. It's a show focused on everything in fantasy books and some sci-fi, too. We look at epic fantasy, urban fantasy, swords and sorcery, space opera, you name it, we've got it here, and you can expect to find the best and brightest authors from all the various corners of the fantasy and sci-fi book world here on the show each week. Starting off this episode, as always, I'll do so with my own update. I turned in the final book to the Huntress Clan Saga this week. Huntress Defender is now in with the editor, and that means I'm ready to move on to focusing my complete attention on the current project. I'm about a quarter of the way through The Paramedics Amazon, the eighth book in the Extreme Medical Services series. That will be coming out sometime this fall, and I'm looking forward to getting that together. Of course, you can always find out more about whatever I'm up to, and you can do that by visiting my fan group over on Facebook, Jamie's Fun Fantasy Readers. We talk about all sorts of fantasy books and movies there, so come by, join the group, and get involved in the discussion. We talk about lots of stuff. You can also catch up with me over on my website and blog at jamiedavisbooks.com. Either way, I hope you'll leave a comment or reach out to me on the contact form on my website. I love hearing from folks, and I hope you'll check in. In this episode, as we get into the main part of it, I do get the fun chat with John R. Rosenman. John was an English professor at Norfolk State University, where he designed and taught a course in how to write science fiction and fantasy. He is a former chairman of the board of the Horror Writers Association and has published 250 stories in places such as Weird Tales, Whitley Strieber's Aliens, Fangoria, Galaxy, Endless Apocalypse, The Age of Wonders, and the Hot Blood Erotic Horror series. John has published 24 books, including science fiction action-adventure novels such as Beyond Those Distant Stars, Speaker of the Shack, A Senseless Act of Beauty, and many more. He also recently published a science fiction novel, Dreamfarer, which is the first in a new series. Here's my fun chat with John, where we talk about his Inspector of the Cross series. Check it out. Hi, John. Welcome to the Books and Authors Fantasy and Sci-Fi Podcast. It's great to have you on the show today.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So you've got a great background, a lot of stuff that you've done and accomplished in your life. So why don't you give us the Cliff Notes version and tell us a little bit about yourself.
Wow. Well, as I mentioned to you before, I'm a retired English professor, retired at 79 years ago. I taught at Norfolk State for 29 years. I'm married 52 years, two children. I have published a couple dozen books, 30 books, if you consider the shorter ones, most of them speculative fiction, horror, fantasy, metafiction. I've written two mainstream novels, one young adult. I published nearly 300 short stories, also in the same genres. One of my novels, a mainstream novel, cost me two jobs. So writing does sometimes come with very serious consequences. In general, as a writer of speculative fiction, two of my major themes are the endless mind-stretching wonders of the universe and the limitless possibilities of transformation, sexual, cosmic, and otherwise. And as for my writing style and approach, I am basically a pantser. I used to go to a certain Barnes & Noble and look around, and stories would leap full-blown practically into my head. Sadly, that no longer occurs, though. As you get older, you change, and your writing style changes with it.
Yeah, you got to adjust to things. Yep. as life throws you things, curveballs and adjustments for you to do. But I certainly know I'm a bit of a pantser myself, but I do a lot more structural work ahead of time now than I used to, for sure.
That's good. It probably is very helpful, and I should probably do that more myself.
Well, a lot less ends up on the cutting floor, so that's...
Yeah, that's true. But I was writing a sequel to a new series, and I just... Suddenly I had the idea that I wanted to have Froggers in the next chapter. So I did it. I just wrote a chapter in which I thought, I've got to have a snake lady and snakes, rattlesnakes, in this chapter. And I did it. And my beta reader is about a couple of years older than I am, also retired English professor. She's I.J. Parker. I'll give her a little plug there. She's just published her 20th novel in the series. And she's very good as well, but she's much more structured than I am.
What does she think about the curveballs you throw in there?
Sometimes she likes them. I'm surprised she liked this chapter. She actually just read it and said, I have almost no problems with it. But I have more curveballs to throw her, and we'll see what happens. She's a wonderful critic, though, and a wonderful editor, which is something writers need.
Yes. You need somebody that's willing to tell you when it works or doesn't work, especially when it doesn't work. But I know, I mean, like, you know, Stephen King is famous for saying that he writes, you know, kind of into the dark, as it were. And he says, if he doesn't know what's coming next, then you don't know what's coming next either. And I kind of like the way that he looks at it that way.
That's a good way to look at it. Incidentally, I didn't mention this in my Cliff Notes summary, but I used to be the chairman of the board of the Horror Writers Association. And one of our trustees was Peter Straub, who collaborated with King in at least one novel.
Excellent. Yeah, it's funny. I have a good friend of mine who's a writer, writes romance novels, lives up in Maine, and, you know, passes by him in the grocery store from time to time. But, you know, she's like, it's no big deal. That's just Steve.
That's right. I saw him once. He's very down to earth. You get a sense of connection with him. No pretenses. He just is what he is.
Yep.
More writers ought to be like that.
More people ought to be like that. And, you know, I have to say, more often than not, when I've met fellow writers, and especially writers that I really look up to, I have been pleasantly surprised at how approachable they are, how down to earth they are, how, you know, just ordinary guys and gals they are. And I think that, you know, I have to learn, you know, to separate my reader, you know, persona of what I picture them to be from, you know, the everyday person that they are, and understand that they're approachable and you can talk to them. And hopefully my readers feel the same way. And
yes,
I know from reading your stuff that, you know, you like to meet with your readers too.
I do like to meet with them. In my tennis group, I have fellow players who are recommending books to me. So I read them and I'm giving my books to them, hoping I can get them addicted or get them recruited to reading some of my stuff. I'm willing to talk about what I do to anybody. It's my favorite subject.
No, definitely. And let's move on into that, because
okay.
I want to talk a little bit about your Inspector of the Cross series. The first in the series is Inspector of the Cross. Tell us a little bit about the premise behind this series and the genesis of how that story came to life for you.
Oh, that's a wonderful question. I think one influence in it was The Forever War by Joel Haldeman, which won the Hugo, the Nebula, I think the Locus Award, about a soldier who is 1,000 years old in a war that seems to last forever. And he's that old because time dilation, as he travels at super fast speeds, means the age is more slowly than others. So you can go back and meet your great-great-great-grandson. And I thought, well, why not create a war that's lasted for about 5,000 years, nearly 5,000 years. And let's go Haldeman one better, with a hero who has lived for nearly 4,000 years because of this. And I wanted to explore the effects of that upon him. And I created a hero. I like to be superlatives. I like to be excessive. I created a hero who is the best that humanity has to offer. He's a product of a black mother and a white man, so the mixture is just right. And he's the best, the most qualified. Why did I use the word inspector? People have asked me about that title. Well, an inspector in Sherlock Holmes, Scotland Yard, goes to investigate a crime. He inspects it. And this hero is an inspector who tries to find a solution to the endless war against an invincible alien enemy by finding a weapon or device that will turn the war against them. And so, like a Flying Dutchman, he travels from distant post to distant post, endlessly searching for a method. And in the Inspector of the Cross, the first in my series, which is now six books long, he finally finds a device that can make all the difference. Only he runs into an obstacle that is truly terrible and which may ultimately destroy the human race.
You know, that's a great premise, and the concept of like an endless war, an endless, yeah, you know, thing, and just the pain and anguish that can cause to a person too, to everyone they've ever known is gone. I mean, that's been touched upon time and again, yes, in, yes, many stories. I mean, good grief, yes, the Planet of the Apes deals with,
yes,
it.
Yes. Yes. He can't go home again. It says, Charlton Heston says, it's all, they're long dead. Everything that was is long dead. You can't go home again.
So, you know, it's just, you know, I think it draws upon a concept that a lot of us maybe don't grasp initially until we do a lot of reading in sci-fi and get, mm-hmm, an understanding of the vastness of the universe and the galaxy, and the many galaxies within the universe, because it is something that I don't think we really comprehend, and a lot of science fiction kind of glosses over it with, you know, the concepts of hyperspace and warp drives, yeah, and things like that, yeah, that allow us to make a trip like we're going across the street. But that's not the case, or at least not given current technology.
I have to confess that in at least one of my novels, Beyond Those Distant Stars, I have a female cyborg. And how does she get from one area, a region of the space to the other? Simple. She goes down a wormy or a black hole. Talk about rapid transit. But it's probable that in reality, it just won't work out that way. Our hero has to be suspended. He has to be in deep sleep, suspended animation, and he pays a heavy price for that. But in Inspector of the Cross, the device he finds is something that can potentially enable warriors, soldiers, agents like him to zip across space. And that would confer upon them, if they can achieve it, the ability to outmaneuver their enemy and travel vast spaces in very short periods.
Well, and you know, I don't belittle the concept of rapid space travel, because without it, a lot of stories just wouldn't work. I mean, you need the convention to make the story have meaning, because otherwise the battle you were fighting would be over.
Yeah. And there have been many variations of it in science fiction. For example, Orson Scott Card's The Ansible.
Mm-hmm.
There are various ways to do it. But Turton really struggles, and he runs into an unseen enemy in the first novel. And I hope if readers read Inspector of the Cross, it will encourage them to read on to other books in the series. What will happen to him? Do they have any chance to beat the enemy? And what happens when he meets a young woman who is eventually going to be an inspector like him?
Now, you've got, it looks like is it five books in the series? Is that the complete series at book five?
Five. I have one which my previous publisher just held on to for a year for complicated reasons I won't go into. So I have the whole whole series transferred to Crossroad Press, and they have the sixth novel, which involves reset the series and have the hero flash forward to a different scene, a mission, and his ship smacks down, has a crash on a planet, and he loses his memory and his face is destroyed. So talk about a reset. And much of the novel is concerned, it's called Crash, very original title, I know, Crash. Most of the rest of the novel centers upon his recovering his memory and identity. So that was a new approach I took.
Oh, that's great. No, I mean, there's all kinds of ways to take a series and yeah. redefine it and re-energize it for your readers and give them something new and exciting to draw upon once you've yeah. closed out tied up the threads that were there to tie up.
And perhaps you never do end it. It can go on forever.
My first series is that way. It's kind of almost a paramedic treating supernatural creatures, so it's kind of almost like a police procedural. Like, as long as I can come up with things to do, I can have a new quote unquote episode and write another book. So I just, when the ideas come to me, that's when new books in that series come out. So
I'll have to look it up.
Yeah.
Yes, I will.
I'm curious, about the difference that you see between your short story work and your novel length work, because you have quite a number of short stories you've written and published. And I'm curious, some people consider themselves short fiction writers and some people consider themselves long form writers. Everybody dabbles in both, I think, a little bit, but I don't know many people that consider themselves really good at both. Do you have a secret to that or a thought process that you shift gears with when you're writing short fiction?
That's a deep thought question. Let me entertain that for a minute. I used to be more of a short story writer. I could write them more quickly. And as I said, ideas would pop suddenly out of nowhere into my head. And so for a while, I was more of a short story writer. I guess in general, I consider myself both. As I've gotten on in years, I don't have a cane yet, but I find that I've gravitated toward writing series. Once you get one novel or two novels in the series, it's easier to continue. Now, Inspector of the Cross, I first wrote that novel, Jamie. I wrote that first nearly 40 years ago. It's like the mainstream novel about three boys growing up, The Merry-Go-Round Man. I wrote that nearly 40 years ago. And both of them sat there for a good three decades. But with me, I'm writing novels more, especially in a series. And also revisiting some of my short stories I published earlier to republish them, often for good money. There's a market for reprints out there. Now, one of my short stories, for example, Free Air, I revised heavily and submitted it to an anthology called A Dying Planet, because it involves a future where there's virtually no air. You have to walk around with a canister in your back and breathe it once every 10.8 seconds. And I first wrote that nearly 40 years ago, 30 years ago. But I consider myself both, I guess, if you had to pin me down, a little both, although I'm more of a novelist these days.
No, it's great. And I'm just looking down your catalog here on your Amazon author page, and I'm seeing lots of intriguing concepts in the descriptions. I love your covers. I'm looking at Beyond Those Distant Stars and Speaker of the Shack. Mm-hmm. There's just lots of good stuff there. And I'm sure you're like me, because you said you walked around and used to just see story ideas pop up. People often ask me how I come up with the ideas that I come up with. And I have to tell them that everything's a story idea. And like, I see a group of ants crossing the sidewalk in front of me.
Right.
And, I get an idea of, well, what are they doing? Where are they going?
Absolutely. And sometimes people say to me, I wish I had ideas, or I had an idea. How can you write and I don't? And I say, well, a lot of it is what the Mike Resnick said, an author I much admire. You apply the seat of your pants to a chair and you start to write and you get in the habit of doing it. I think writing is largely that. I'll tell you one story idea I got. It seems to stand out. I was walking through Barnes & Noble and I saw a book called The Calm Technique. C-A-L-M, the calm technique, a book about making yourself calm. And all of a sudden, a title leapt into my head, The Death Technique, about a man who was born with a mutation, I guess you could call it. If he wants, he can will himself to decompose and to become dead or to appear dead, and then he can reassemble himself. I got a story out of that, which I sold to a horror anthology edited by John Palin for the Horror Writers of America. That's just one example.
No, it's just, you know, it's just amazing, you know, how our brains work. I'm often impressed with the twists and things that come out of my mind while I'm writing. And you're right about putting your butt in the chair. I mean, it is, I make myself write something new every single day. And it's not always a lot, but, you know, I try to get a couple hundred words down at the very minimum. Often it's a lot more, but you know, even if it's having a bad day, I pull out my phone and I start writing something. Trying to continue this concept I'm working on at the time. And I think that that's important because it makes you be able to shift gears quickly and get into that creative mode. And I think that's sometimes people underestimate the challenge that you can create for yourself on your own to not be creative when you just have to start writing something. I call it making a sandwich. Somebody asked me, what do you do when you get writer's block? And I go, I make a sandwich. What does that mean? Well, you know, I got the idea when I was stuck on a story and the guy was in a kitchen. So I had him make a sandwich. And by the time he was done making the sandwich, I knew what he was going to do next. And
yes.
The sandwich got cut, but the rest of the story kept going. And so that's what I tell people. I say, just have them do the next thing that you would do if you're in that room or in that hallway or in that forest, you know, and it can be just to put another foot in front of the other until you come up with the next thing.
Yeah. I describe it for me as like walking through a fog and you see very discernible features of the landscape ahead. That's often the way it is for me. You mentioned writer's block. I once wrote and published a story called Writer's Block, and it stemmed from the fact that I had a writer's group that I belonged to for 20 years. I left that group after one meeting, came home, and where the hell was my briefcase? No idea. So ultimately, I wrote a story about a writer who's developing Alzheimer's, and that's the first sign of it. Fortunately, that did not apply to me because I went back and got my briefcase.
Well, that's good. Yeah, that's, you know, I think about, Terry Pratchett, and just, you know, the how sad I was to hear when, you know, before he passed that he had Alzheimer's, and how he continued to write. And I was so impressed with him to continue to push forward and try to assemble his stories that were coming from such a rich mind. Such a terrible affliction.
Yeah, it is.
To lose yourself that way.
You lose your soul. You lose who you are. You lose everything.
Yeah, it's, you know, that bring out my nurse side, because I don't practice clinically anymore. But as a nurse, I just feel for people that way, and often wonder what goes through people's minds when they have those moments, and it's hard. But then I think that makes me a better writer too, because I'm able to kind of bring that feeling into the story, or try to at least.
You enhance your humanity by developing that sympathy, that empathy. I know with the people in my age group, many of them are worried, more or less, some more than others, about losing their memory. You know, there's one fellow who gets mad at people and can't remember why. and yet he can function in other ways. So it's, and we don't have a solution, at least yet. Say, you haven't asked me about my metafiction.
No, I haven't. Why don't you tell me about it?
Because
we're getting down near the end, so this is a perfect time to do that. Let's get it in there.
Humorous metafiction. Ever heard of it?
No.
Okay. I'll give an example. I wrote one story, and I kept falling out of my chair with laughter, practically falling. It's about a man who's been a prisoner for a nameless crime and or nameless sin, and he finally hijacks a plane. Before he does, before he hijacks a plane, he goes into a room, and only two people there, and the walls aren't furnished. And he says, something's wrong with this room. And that one of the men there, one of the cops, says, that's because, as a writer, you haven't fully envisioned your environment. And then he takes off in a plane, and the man he left behind is there in the ship with him. And it's because he's not in control of his characters. In other words, it humorously examines the nature of a work of art, a work of written art, and calls attention to the fact that it is an artificial construction. Now, it's funnier when you read it, I hope, than the way I explained it.
Well, no,
I got a real kick out of poking fun at myself.
I think that's great, and you know you're right. I mean, so much of our stories are often like those Hollywood Western towns that are really just the fronts of the buildings, right?
Yes.
I mean, you don't get to the inside. You only go inside the buildings you have to go into. The rest of them are just the fronts of the buildings.
They're just cardboard or paper mache constructs. But I've tried to write in a variety of areas, metafiction, humorous metafiction. I wrote one, just recently published had to write for an anthology that was one focused in the West. And I combined that with an artificial construction of a town that just exists in cyberspace. I'd like to try a little bit of this, a little bit of that. I've written one 202,000 word story, which I can never sell, and probably for good reason. But I like to take chances. I'm not always inclined to carefully plan everything out.
I think there's nothing wrong with that. I write whatever the next, I mean, I plan for business purposes, but I often, yeah. I always have a passion project that I write on every year, because I think that it's important to write for my art alone, as well as write for my readers too.
Yes. Yes. You have to, I guess you're wise if part of you makes it a business. And in which you build up a reader base and keep them happy and keep them waiting for the next book in the series. But I also like to write short stories, which are just one-time things, usually with no sequence and no sequel.
And there's a place for those. There are times when I've sat down and had just a few minutes, and I enjoy having a complete story happen in that time frame, you know, where I'm just reading for 10 or 15 minutes.
Yes.
And, you know, I liked having everything wrapped up from that little piece of fiction. And there's a time and a place for short stories. And I think, yes. You know, for readers out there that haven't really delved into some of the great short story anthologies out there, there are some wonderful short stories out there, and a lot of them may lead you into a universe that has fully fleshed out novels that go beyond. So there are opportunities there to find and discover new authors, to find and discover new characters. And for me as an author, often my short stories are my my cameo characters from my novels that I give them an opportunity to shine on their own short stories from time to time.
And do you ever you promote them to some of your novels?
I do. I always have a link to the story, you know, the series they come from in the back of the short story for those who want to look at them. But they're really, I often just give them away to my readers on my email group You know, just say, hey, here's something about this character. I know a lot of you like that one. So see if you see what you think of a little bit of his backstory and or what what little bit of trouble he got into or she got into. So that's just kind of, it gives me an opportunity to kind of have some fun in a short format. And it also gives them a little something, little nugget of something in between books.
So you would audition them. If you perform well, if there's a clamor of excitement about you, a buzz, I may put you in a novel.
Yep.
Promote you. Yeah. Let me tell you about one story recently I published. I mentioned before that some of my stories I can't sell. I can't sell. And they lie dormant, inert for decades. One I recently took out, revised with the help of my beta reader. And it's in a book called Little Boy Lost, published by Madison Press. And that came from the fact that in the 50s, when I grew up, there was a gumball machine. And it had, one of the gumballs was colored, I think, green and yellow, had stripes. And that was a winner. So I took that and wrote about a gumball machine in a 1950s drugstore, which was a super winner. And but the threat it could ultimately pose to the boy who won it, because he could lose his soul. The book is called Little Boy Lost.
Wow. I'm and, writing that one down. I'll have to include that link to for the notes of this.
Yeah, it's well worth it.
John, it sounds like you and I could probably sit here and talk books for the rest of the afternoon.
I think we could. I think we could.
But it's been fantastic talking with you, and I know the readers are going to enjoy taking a look at your books and your short stories as well, and make sure I link to as much as I can in the show notes so they can find you.
I would appreciate it, because I could use the sales. One book which is sold recently pretty well is all my Audible books, audio books. And A Sense of Beauty, my longest and most experimental, most difficult one to write, is African science fiction. African science fiction. It's done pretty well. Please provide a link to that.
Okay.
If you can.
I will do that. John, thanks a lot for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
We get this, get your stories out there so folks can check them out.
Thank you, and I'll look up some of your books, I promise.
And that's going to wrap up this episode of the Books and Authors Fantasy Podcast. Make sure you catch up with us for a whole lot more from the fantasy and sci-fi focused community, which you will find over on Facebook, as well as over on the website fantasy-focus.com. Leave a comment on this episode. Let me know what's on your mind. I love hearing from you. Also, while you're over on the website, you can find a link on each podcast episode post to subscribe to the show. You can find those links whether you're on an iOS or an Android device. You can even subscribe by email if you want. But we want to make sure you catch all the upcoming episodes, including our next one with Sean Crow on the show. You won't want to miss that one. That's it for this episode of the Books and Authors Fantasy and Sci-Fi Podcast. As always, I am your host, Jamie Davis, author of Fun Fantasy Reads. Don't forget to follow me over on Facebook in my reader group, Jamie's Fun Fantasy Readers, or on my website, jamiedavisbooks.com. And while you're over at the website, if you want a free copy of one of my books, I have one I'm giving away there. Just sign up for the newsletter. You'll get the free book, and you can check out some of the stuff I've written. Whatever you do, though, subscribe. Come back here for the next podcast. And in the meantime, don't forget to keep your eyes open out there, folks, because there's magic all around you.